intrinsic value?
This cost $18.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and the question. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, why, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Chris Pinto. And Chris has put together a wonderful video. It's called Megiddo, The March to Armageddon. And it's over 2 hours video, but very professionally done, trying to put together the understanding that there really are secret societies in the world, and they did influence the production of the wars of the last century. But behind these secret societies are the spiritual forces which are moving the United States, indeed the whole world, towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. Chris, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me again, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell us, now you're working on a new version, or at least the next stage. When will that be available?
That is, we are hoping to have it available by the end of August, early September. Just had a number of setbacks this summer, but we've been working on it pretty diligently.
Well, I tell you, your first one did a magnificent job. A lot of graphics, a lot of excellent art, a lot of film clips, and just weaving this whole incredible story together so well. It's really must-seeing for anybody who is concerned about what's happening, not only from a geopolitical but from a spiritual point of view. So why don't you just tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how it happened that you gave up your career and secular filmmaking and went into making your own Christian films?
Well, I was pursuing independent filmmaking, I guess, for about 10 years. I spent some time in Atlanta and then in New York, and worked as a playwright and a screenwriter and so on. And then the Lord turned my life around, he showed me through a series of events, and ultimately me getting into Bible study and spending some time in Christian fellowship, I came to realize that all of the pursuits that I had been chasing down in the world were vain and just not profitable. And so the Lord turned my life around and set me on a course seeking His will rather than my own. And so I spent a number of years trying to figure out what God wanted me to do for Him. And I had written a script for an independent Christian film company and sort of thought that was a direction the Lord was going to take me in. But I didn't quite know to what extent. And early on in my walk, I had, I would say, no interest at all in things pertaining to the occult, things, the evil side, if you will, of the Christian faith. That is, things having to do with Satan or hell or demons or any of that information I really stayed away from. I was only interested in my walk with the Lord Jesus and pursuing things that pertain to Him and just pursuing the good news, or at least what I perceived to be the good news. And I just shied away from any references to the enemy. But it seemed like the more I shied away from them, the more that it seemed that God would show me what's going on. And then a few years into this, I was at a friend's house, and they were Christians, and they just very casually handed me a video called Rock and Roll Sorcerers of the New Age Revolution. And I was very leery about watching it, and thought, in fact, that I wasn't really going to watch it. I just took it to be polite, and I thought, well, I'll watch 10 or 15 minutes of it, and then I'll just kind of tell them, oh, yeah, I saw that, but, you know, I couldn't get through it. Yeah, it looked interesting, you know, and then pass it off like that. But I put it in, and I ended up watching the first 15 minutes, and I was so compelled by what I saw that I sat there for about 3.5 hours and couldn't get up and was just really stunned. It was the first time I had seen somebody take Bible prophecy and begin to show how prophecy was being fulfilled before our very eyes in the culture that is all around us, and in things that I was very aware of, things that I was familiar with. This presentation focused on the music industry and how Satanism is working through the music industry to bring about what is known as the New Age, which is the New Aquarian Age, which ultimately goes hand in hand with the New World Order. A lot of, if you will, patriots and people who are sort of conspiracy teachers who look only at the political side and not at the spiritual, they don't recognize that the New Age movement is the kissing cousin of the New World Order, and that it's the religious aspect, the spiritual powers that are driving this New World Order forward, ultimately. But this teacher, you know, showed how, you know, he talked about how this gathering, he's quoting from the book of Revelation, Pastor Joe Schimmel, and he's quoting how there are demons that are sent forth, spirits of demons that go forth to the kings of the earth and all the world to gather them together for that great day of God Almighty. And it says ultimately he gathers them together in the place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. And Pastor Joe talked about how this gathering was happening at so many different levels in the world. And it was happening politically, happening with world religion, and his particular focus in his presentation, he was demonstrating how it was taking place through the music industry and how Satan was using music to bring about this one world universal thinking to unite mankind in what would ultimately be the New World Order, Satan's New World Order, very clearly, that these things were being driven by the powers of darkness, by the working of Satan himself. And so it was a pretty startling presentation, and it set me on a course to investigate these things more fully and to find out things I didn't know back then. It's been about 5 or 6 years. I didn't know what the New World Order was. I'd heard different whisperings about it. You know, every now and again somebody flips over a dollar bill and shows you that eye on the pyramid and, you know, talks about, oh, this is a conspiracy thing, and maybe you hear something about Freemasonry, you might hear the word the Illuminati, but if you haven't taken the time to investigate these things, you might not be familiar with them. And even for a lot of people who have investigated them, they're sometimes not aware of the in-depth historical information that supports these things, that pulls them really out of the realm of rumor and hearsay that is so often thought to be what, you know, conspiracy theories are all about, is rumor and so on, and brings them into that realm of fact and into the realm of history. And then, of course, you begin to wonder as you uncover these various pages of history, you begin to wonder, hey, wait a minute, why weren't we taught these things in school? I didn't know that George Washington wrote about the Illuminati. I didn't know that there was a guy named Adam Weishaupt, who I've never heard before, who founded this organization, and Thomas Jefferson knew who he was. Thomas Jefferson spoke about this man. Why didn't I ever hear of these things? This is what my investigations led me to, Dr. Stan, and I spent a number of years going around and investigating and interviewing different people who were who I'd been studying with, people whose books I was reading and whose other documentaries that I had seen and so on, guys like Dave Hunt, Tom McMahon, Carol Matriciana, Pastor Joe Schimmel himself, who really his presentation is what started me on that course, and began to collect these interviews, people like William T. Still and others who wrote, who have written books and so on that I thought are very worthwhile on the subject. And so I began collecting these interviews and ended up with about, I would say, 10 hours, maybe more than 10 hours worth of interviews from all of these different authors and teachers and so on, and had it in mind to put together a documentary, and I thought it was somehow or other going to be just a single documentary, but realized a few years into it that the subject matter is so vast and so gigantic that it takes a... I don't know. You know, right now I'm thinking to do 5 parts in a series that will cover maybe 10 or 12 hours of material ultimately, but of course that's certainly not going to cover everything there is to talk about.
Well, you know, Chris, I've been studying this for 42 years, and I'm still constantly learning and finding the new machinations of this incredible movement, which works behind the scenes. It's there. It's infiltrated every aspect of the Christian ministries. It's infiltrated our court systems, our corporations, our government, the great tax-exempt foundations. And, of course, it is all Luciferian. Is intent upon creating this world government for the Antichrist. And the great tragedy is today why they don't talk about these things in the church. We avoid any mention of anything of that sort. In fact, I was just reading a very prominent Christian magazine put out by the largest Christian ministry, and the latest issue has an article on the dollar, and it goes into the background of the dollar and the symbolism on the dollar, and it gives it all, such a glorious background, and they never go into the fact that this is occultic, it is Masonic, the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill represents the symbols of the ancient mystery religions, the eye is the eye of Horus, of Lucifer, and you talk to the Luciferians, they all know that. And what I see a Christian magazine coming out telling us that the symbology is just, it's just all so patriotic, and I mean, who was on the committee that put it together? Well, the people who were on the committee that put it together were tied into the occult, very strongly tied into the occult. And yet the average Christian reading that will have no idea he's being brainwashed by his own Christian ministry that he's probably supporting.
Yeah, one of the things that we... it's interesting that you mention that, Dr. Stan. One of the things we talk about in Megiddo Part 1 is a bit of the history of Freemasonry, especially here in America. But what we're talking about now in Part 2, in fact, I was working on that section before you called, is to show people that these objections to secret societies and occultism and these dark practices that are really working to very intentionally to corrupt what was the original intent of liberty and freedom here in this country to begin with, and to pervert those things and to turn it into something that it was never meant to be. But that there were many people who objected to Freemasonry, who objected to these secret societies, men like John Quincy Adams, you know, American president, who wrote against Freemasons. I think Tex Mars on his website has a book that's better than 300 pages worth of material from former President Adams. William Still, in his book on the New World Order, quotes Millard Fillmore, the 13th President of the United States, who was an ex-Mason who spoke against Freemasonry. There were many people. In fact, with the incident of Captain William Morgan, who was the Mason who kind of exposed a lot of the occult dealings in Masonry.
And they killed him, of course.
Yeah, they turn around and they kill the guy. And there was such an outrage that an anti-Masonic party was formed in America during the 19th century. A lot of us haven't known these things, and we're certainly not taught these things in school. But there were many people who used to speak out against this, pastors, teachers, people, you know, who hold political office, would speak out against these dealings. But through the 20th century, it's like this great, you know, quiet. As you said many times before, they don't talk about it in the churches. They don't talk about it on the news. Nobody says a word about it. And, you know, I'm still trying to figure out, honestly, what happened. At what point did the whole thing change? Did they just stop, you know, fighting against it like they used to? Because they used to fight really hard against this.
Well, I think what happened, Chris, I think what happened was that they infiltrated the seminaries probably 75 years ago. And, of course, the Masons were told to infiltrate the Christian churches in the 1920s. So they got their people under the churches and then onto the boards of the churches and into the seminaries and then teaching in the seminaries. And they very subtly shifted the thrust of Christianity. And, of course, they taught the young ministers they were not to be involved in anything but saving souls. And then, of course, they were saving souls. But they took away so much of the teaching of they don't talk about hell because, well, that doesn't sell very much. And you certainly don't want to talk about sin. After all, it makes people feel uncomfortable. And you never talk about eternal punishment. So you change the basic thrust of the gospel because, of course, if we're not sinners saved by grace and there is eternal punishment, why do we need a Savior? I mean, there's no reason to have a Savior at all. And they've done what they've done very subtly. They're not going to come out and tell you what they really believe. Two of the major occultists involved were men named Westcott and Hort, and they actually created the Greek translation. It's like sort of a Greek dictionary that the ministers all across America use, and of course that's where they get their Greek wording from and the knowledge of Greek. Westcott and Hort were deeply involved with the occult, and of course all of their teachings, whatever they wrote, was pushed in that direction. But the average minister doesn't have any idea, and he's probably using a Westcott and Hort dictionary, Greek dictionary, right at the present time. So, you know, until we have a means of reaching people and understanding that this pervades every aspect of our society, and I really think the most important thing is the realization that there have been two forces at work in America. One, the occult, and it came here in 1640. It was intent upon taking over America and using the power and wealth and military might of this country to lead the world into this one world government. And then there was the Christian, and the Christian was dominant for so long, but gradually it became complacent, it was infiltrated, and it was sort of neutralized. It created sort of a warm, fuzzy Christianity that would never challenge anybody, and certainly nobody would ever feel uncomfortable coming out of church. You just wanted to feel good about yourself, and of course, that's why we're in the trouble we are today, and why the church, in many respects, is not as relevant as it was, and why we're losing America.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've been fascinated, Dr. Stan, with, you know, what's happened to America. And I've been spending a lot of time investigating the, you know, the early settlers who came to this country back in the 1600s. And, I mean, I'd never realized that really I trace America back prior to 1776. I mean, men like George Washington and Madison and Jefferson and all those guys, they had to have something to fight for. You know, they didn't just get off the boat, grab their muskets, and then say, all right, let's, you know, fight against the King of England and so on. There was a nation, there was a country that had been established here, and that country was established for about a century and a half, maybe a little bit longer, prior to the Revolutionary War.
Well, you think what people have forgotten is that the first settlers really arrived here, of course, at Jamestown, but the Pilgrims came in 1620, and certainly the occultists came in 1640, and they began trying to pervert the morals of the people. By 1730, they'd done a tremendous job. The country as a whole had turned against God. They destroyed Harvard University, which was created to teach men to train them to be ministers. It pretty well corrupted Yale University. And then, of course, along came Jonathan Edward and a couple of others, John Wesley. And the first Great Awakening turned America back towards God. And it was out of that a great first Great Awakening in 1740 that came the very seeds of the revolution and the dedication to this idea of individual freedom under God. Whose heritage we've inherited. We'll be back in just a moment with Chris Pinto here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Chris Pinto, and his video is Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, and I recommend it to you very, very strongly. It does a wonderful job in this, so go ahead and pick up the story from there, Chris.
Well, working on Megiddo has been very exciting. Been a lot of work, and I guess we were talking a few minutes ago about Megiddo Part 2 a little bit. I was sharing with some of the research that we're doing on that, and how in Part 1 we talk about secret societies and in particular Freemasonry and the Illuminati at work on American soil. After the American Revolution. In Part 1, we talk about how the Illuminati tried to bring about a re-revolution in America to try and create the same effect, as William T. Still puts it, that the Jacobins, who were the organization that the Illuminists were working through, had brought about in France, where they tried to tear down Christianity entirely through a guy named Anacharsis Clootz and others. Clootz was Weishaupt's hand-picked representative during that time. And we talk about this in Megiddo Part 1. And how their agenda is specifically aimed at the destruction of Christianity, and then under the guise of atheism, the removal of the idea of God, to ultimately usher in a satanic world order, where the world will be sooner or later conditioned through this, you know, various process of order out of chaos. The world is to be ultimately conditioned into the universal worship of Lucifer. And so we show in Part 1 how this movement is working through the move through what is called the New World Order. And what we're going to show in Part 2 is the spiritual and the religious, if you will, side of how this movement is working through the New Age movement. But we talk more about Masonry in America, and one of the things we were mentioning earlier is about how there was a time in America when people really stood up against Freemasonry, how they really stood up against these secret societies and their corrupting influence in our government and in our society as a whole, especially where making laws and so on are concerned and covering up people who are Masons and perhaps guilty of certain acts. William T. Still shows the account, although it's over in England, of Jack the Ripper, how Jack the Ripper was very likely a Freemason who wrote down a Masonic code word at one of his crime scenes, and it's believed that that was what ultimately led to him never being caught. And that's just one example of how Masonry can, you know, work to cover up injustice through the good old boy system. Anyway, in America, there was a time when they spoke out. Now, you were mentioning how you believe that the change came when the secret societies, the Masonic orders and so on, infiltrated our seminaries and our, you know, Bible teaching schools and churches and so on. It's interesting, when I interviewed William T. Still, and we're going to show this in Part 2, he talks about having spoken to a Baptist preacher who was a Freemason some years ago. And he was attending a church for a little time, And it was a small little Baptist church out in the middle of nowhere.
Hold that thought for just a moment,
sure.
Glenn. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Chris Pinto. We're talking about his video, Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. And in the first one, which is Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, of course, this is going to have several more coming down the line, but the first one is really fascinating because it goes into the influence of Masonry, certainly on the wars, its influence on our societies, shows you the picture of Albert Pike, who was the founder of modern-day Masonry, was a Luciferian. It's right there in Washington, D.C., and not too far from the Masonic headquarters there. And they have the great temple in Washington, D.C. The entire city of Washington is laid out in Masonic or astrological terms and with symbolism. And the average individual has no idea the influence there. Every major building in Washington, D.C. has a Masonic plaque on it. And I dare say that every Masonic building in the city in which every one of you who are listening live has a Masonic symbol on it. And, of course, we're told there's a separation of church and state, and yet the Masonry is a religion. But the God that they worship is not the God of the Bible. And yet, of course, most Masons really don't understand. You have to get up to the upper degrees. You have to begin to contemplate. You have to read Morals and Dogma, the writings of Albert Pike, whose statue is there in Washington, D.C. And then you suddenly begin to realize that you get total freedom when you reject the God of the Bible, because he's a negative God who puts all the restrictions on you. And you gain freedom when you accept Lucifer's promise to do whatever you want. That is, it gives you the ultimate freedom, the same story that the serpent told Eve there in the Garden of Eden. And they make it very clear that it all ties together. You really need to get the information, study it. We can get you it for you if you're interested in it. But you were saying, Chris, that you were talking to William Still, and he was telling about talking to a Baptist minister who was a Mason.
Yeah, he was talking about this Baptist minister who had been a Mason. And he was now a pastor at a very small church. And he said that he had a career when he was a Masonic Baptist preacher that was on the rise. He was the pastor of a big church and so on. This was the impression. And at one point, his conscience got to him about the Masonic order. And so he decided to quit Masonry, you know, to give it up. And he said at that point, at the point that he departed from Masonry, his career as a Baptist preacher just, you know, plummeted. And he suffered, you know, greatly as a result, because he was somewhat blackballed for having abandoned Masonry. William Still, in fact, who's in outside Washington, D.C. in Virginia, when I interviewed him, he had been like a head deacon at a church there, and he told me the story. He and his wife shared this with me about how he'd been a head deacon, and one of his fellow deacons had come in, or he was the head usher, I think, and one of the fellow ushers, they had a pretty large church, and one of the fellow ushers came in one day wearing his Masonic pin, okay, with the square and the compass on it. And, you know, can you even just imagine, if you read William Still's book and all that he says about Masonry, to be at his church under his authority and show up with a Masonic pin is almost comical. But William Still walked over to the guy and he said, what are you doing? And he said, what do you mean? He said, what's that pin? What is that? Why are you wearing that here at church? And he says, oh, I'm just advertising a bit, you know, in case anybody, you know, is interested. And Still had a problem with it. He told the guy, look, you got to take that pin off. You cannot wear that in church. Okay, you can't wear that here. And the guy had a big problem with it. To make a long story short, he ends up going to the pastor and the elders, this Mason guy does, and Still ends up being fired, if you will, from his position as a head usher.
Well, we actually carry a book by Charles Finney that, of course, the great evangelists of the Second Great Awakening, but he tells, of course, his experience in Masonry, and then there are four separate stories there from ministers who had great and successful ministries and churches, and of course, when they spoke out against Masonry, every one of them lost their churches. this is the way things really are in America today. And in fact, one of them had an attempt on his life. So we're not talking about something imaginary. We're talking about something organized evil. Six of our last 12 presidents have either been Masons or directly related to Masonry. One of them accepted the 33rd degree when he was in the Oval Office. Another was the top top de Molay, member of de Molay in the country, a senior member of de Molay. In fact, that's the reason he was not impeached. They couldn't impeach Bill Clinton because the man on the other side in the Senate who would lead the impeachment was Trent Lott, a 33rd degree Mason. And, of course, that would be a violation of their oath to do anything to a fellow Mason. The Brotherhood is far more important than the oath to the Constitution. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Chris Pinto. His video is Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, would like to call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And so, Chris, William Still was very aware that this masonry, this movement, had really thoroughly infiltrated the Christian and Protestant church, wasn't he?
Yeah, in fact, he makes the comment. I haven't chased down the numbers, but he makes the comment in the interview that it's somewhere around 70% of the, I think the leadership, he says, in the major denominations, when he's talking about Baptists and Methodists and Lutherans and so on, are infiltrated by various forms of masonry. And it's pretty staggering to consider. I've heard over and over and over again, although I've never been to one, that every year in the Southern Baptist Convention they have a huge issue over that issue, you know, over whether or not Freemasonry should be allowed in Southern Baptist churches. The last church I was going to before I, you know, started going to Pastor Joe's church in Simi Valley, was a church I'd been going there for a couple of years and was just beginning to study Masonry and learn about it. And one day in a fellowship meeting after service, we were all standing in a big circle joining hands and we're singing some, you know, old gospel song or whatever, and we're kind of swinging hands, and I'm standing next to this older gentleman who was like a, you know, one of the deacons in the church, and he'd been there just for years and years and years. He was like in his 80s. I swing his hand up next to mine, and I turn, I look, and I see that he's wearing a big Masonic ring with a square and a compass on it. And it was like an episode of The Twilight Zone for me at the time. I was, you know, oh my gosh, he's a Mason, you know. No, but I didn't know how to react at the time because I was just learning about it.
Of course, and the thing is that there's so many Masons who really have no idea. They've been in lodge all their lives. They don't understand the occult background. They don't understand the significance of the oaths that they swear. And they certainly don't understand who the God of Masonry really is. That's the tragedy. You never know whether they know or whether they don't know.
Yeah, you know, the sense that I got from talking to him, I ended up writing him a letter and sending him a video on it, and the sense that I got from him was that he doesn't know. And then I was later confronted by, it turns out, the first guy
hold,
I met.
Hold just a thought there.
Sure. Sure.
Our guest this evening, Chris Pinto, we're talking about his experience in his own church, finding that one of the senior deacons was a member of the Masonic Order. And as I was saying, most Masons, people who are associated with this movement, have no idea who the God of Masonry is. They don't understand the occult foundation, as Mammy P. Hall, who is a Satanist, wrote in his book, Lectures in Ancient Philosophy. Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, an outer fraternity of people who have a good time and try to do good, but an inner fraternity of people who study the Ancorum and Ancornorum, which is the secret, and the secret of secrets. And what is that secret of secrets? Why, the secret is Lucifer is God. Go ahead and pick up the story there, Chris.
Yeah, that's just what you said, Dr. Stan. Most of these guys don't know. I ended up being confronted by another guy in the church who was a 32nd degree Mason, and he was very upset. He ended up going to the pastor of the church and complaining against me because I was speaking against Freemasonry. Now, all of my positions against Freemasonry, I didn't get when I was debating with this guy. I didn't debate conspiracy information. I didn't tell him about Albert Pike or any of that stuff. What I did was I just let him talk to me about Masonry, and he openly admitted that Masons worship any god, you know. They accept any religion. He began to talk to me about reincarnation and his belief in that. And so now this is in the middle of what is supposed to be a church dedicated to the Lord Jesus Christ and the gospel, supposedly. And he's in a position of leadership there in the church. And he's talking to me about these things, and I just kept confronting him with the scriptures about how, you know, Paul wrote to the Corinthians saying that you cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. You know, he says, I tell you, the sacrifice of the Gentiles, that is, all the other gods, they sacrifice unto demons and not to God. He says, you cannot drink of the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. And he says, I would not that you have fellowship with demons. So the Bible makes it very clear that for the Christian, we cannot worship as the nations worship their gods, and we cannot acknowledge that their God is the same as our God, which is entirely what Freemasonry is all about. It's about removing the idea of a holy or separate God and saying God is not holy, he's not separate, he's mixed in with everything else. He's the same as all those other gods over there. And all of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation is dedicated to refuting that idea. God is making it very clear as the seraphim cry in Isaiah, holy, holy, holy is the Lord. The God of the Bible is holy. He is separate. And he's not to be confused with other higher powers. He is the Most High God. And so, just in witnessing to these guys, just from Scripture, just from the Bible, that I would have thought would have convicted them as Christians, became very offensive to this Elder Mason, and he insisted that I come down. They have every year they have some ceremony of the Rosy Cross. I don't fully understand the ceremony, but it's something that's open to the public. In other words, they can bring guests if they want to. Whereas the rest of their meetings are all closed. So this is was at a Masonic lodge in Pasadena, California. And he actually invited me down there. And I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to go. But after his continued insistence, I began to think that maybe the Lord wanted me to go just so that I could see certain side of Masonry. So I went down there and I actually sat through this ceremony, and this guy was this 32nd degree Mason was my escort. Now, I didn't participate in anything. I was just an observer. And I just observed this ceremony. And as I was walking through this Masonic hall and looking at the pictures and this big giant bronze bust of Albert Pike over there and the copies of Morals and Dogma that they had and the double-headed eagles that were all over the walls and watching the men, you know, do the Pledge of Allegiance and then put their hands over their shoulders and they'd all say, so mote it be, you know, in this, you know, booming elder voices, and watching the ceremony, I realized that everything I'd been studying about Freemasonry was absolutely true. And all the information out there about the ceremonies and, you know, anybody who tries to tell you that Albert Pike is not such an important fellow in Freemasonry, let him know that he's a very important figure in Freemasonry, and he's the guy who reveals the fact that, along with Manly P. Hall, that Lucifer is ultimately the god of Masonry.
And of course, I think that one of the most interesting things with a Mason that you can tell them, you know, ask them where they will stand for their judgment. Well, they every Masonic funeral, and they always have Masonic funerals along with regular funerals for people, why they're told that the Mason will stand before the Great White Throne of Judgment. And the problem is the Mason is having such a good time and reading so much Masonic lore, he's not reading the scriptures. But if you read the scriptures, you find out that the only people who stand before the Great White Throne of Judgment are the damned, those going to hell. And that fact and that fact alone should get an awful lot of Masons to begin to question what this is all about, because they're looking forward to standing before the Great White Throne of Judgment, the judgment of the damned. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest this evening is Chris Pinto, who has a wonderful video. It's called Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. And in the first part of this, it goes a great deal into the history of the wars of the last century, and certainly the fact that at Yalta, you had making the decisions for the post-world after World War II were Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill. And all three of them were Masons. Now, admittedly, Stalin was a Rosicrucian, but Rosicrucians are part and parcel of Masonry. In fact, they even have a degree of the Rosy Cross within Masonry. But the average Mason doesn't understand that, and that was the bond between these people, why Roosevelt was so close to good old Joe Stalin, one of the greatest mass murderers of all time, a man who hated God. So, Chris, you know, I think that a lot of that footage in there, you just carry people through so well. I mean, as you begin to introduce them to this whole subject of the secret societies that create the wars of modern times.
Right. What we try to do, Dr. Stan, is to show the progression of this movement. And we started back in Bavaria, and we show it in, you know, Bavaria with Weissant, how it went up through the French Revolution, and then how it came to America. It tried to, anyway. And we sort of leave it hanging with this quote from an American pastor of that period in the early 1800s who talked about the lodges of the Illuminati who had come onto American soil. But, of course, many of us don't believe that those lodges ever fully disappeared. And then we talk about the Russian Revolution and have a big quote from Winston Churchill, who acknowledged all of this stuff. We talk about Karl Marx and communism and then the Russian Revolution and how this movement went up through the Russian Revolution, but then its impact was felt in the first two world wars. And how these two world wars that took place were part of a much greater plan. And then, of course, at the end of the video, we show with William T. Still, who records it in his book, this plan set down by Masons Albert Pike and another Italian Mason named Giuseppe Mazzini, and a letter that Mazzini wrote to Albert Pike, actually designing a plan for three world wars back in 1870 that would ultimately bring the world, that would create enough chaos at a global level to change, to bring about a sort of paradigm shift, something that you hear a lot about in the New Age, but to change the belief system, to change the mentality of the people of planet Earth, and ultimately bring them into this universal New World Order system.
But of course they plan a third world war, and that is really why you can see today that American troops are stationed over in Iraq, and anybody who thinks they're coming home has to be incredibly naive. In fact, we have a quotation from the president in my latest newsletter, that's the August newsletter, and the 2nd of June when he was talking about to the Air Force cadets graduating there in Colorado Springs on the 2nd of June. And he was saying that this wonderful war we have in the Middle East, but it's not going to end with Iraq. We're going to bring democracy to all of the Middle East, and it's going to take decades. Now, in the process, I believe we're going to get a blowback. We're going to get a counter-reaction to that. Iran is in full production for war, and we're not talking about just plain old war. We're talking about nuclear war, and Iran has submarines and ships, and she can bring those right off our coast. And if we think we're going to be able to simply attack those countries over there and not have retribution here, I think the American people are incredibly naive. We know that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and they're one heartbeat away from putting them in the hands of the radical Islamic movement, because so many of the people there in Pakistan have embraced this radical form of Islam that we promoted all during the Afghan war in the 1980s. And in fact, we've worked with Pakistani intelligence, which embraces this radical form of Islam. And of course, they've given nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia. We're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and the average American is just totally oblivious. They think things are going to go on forever. It'll never happen here. And we're doing everything we can because to promote a third world war, to inflame the anger and hostility of the Muslim world. That's why our Defense Department released those pictures of the torture at Abu Ghraib prison to the entire world. They could have kept them classified and secret, but they didn't do it, and the question is, why didn't they? And I believe we're setting ourselves up for a terrible, terrible Third World War. And that's exactly what Albert Pike and Mazzini were writing about back in the 1870s, isn't it?
Yeah, that was their plan, and they outlined it pretty well. The Third World War is supposed to erupt, according to the letter that was written, somehow between Israel and her Arab neighbors, or the Jews and the Muslims.
I don't know how, somehow. I mean, it should be so obvious that that war is coming, and coming very soon. And that's one reason why we've got our troops over there.
Well, it's not only is the... Now, here's the part where I think even more significant than Pike and Mazzini's letter, because clearly, if you look at their plan in the Second World War, their plan for the Second World War was that all of Europe would be given to this empire that was erected as a result of the First World War, during the First World War, and that was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was supposed to take possession of all of Europe. Well, they only got half of Europe at the meeting at Yalta, which, you know, once you examine this letter, as you and I have done, and then it begins to make sense why FDR would just suddenly, out of the blue, hand over half of Europe with Winston Churchill to Stalin, who was every bit as much a murderer as Adolf Hitler and a dictator and so on, and was his co-invader of Poland that kicked off World War II. So the plan actually reveals, I think, it actually makes sense of why FDR would do something like that, because no other argument seems to explain it away. But while Pike and Mazzini's plan is not fulfilled to the letter, it's amazing that God's plan is being fulfilled to the letter. And so part of what we show in Megiddo is something that a lot of people are not aware of, and that is the idea of Armageddon is not simply a final battle between good and evil, but that Armageddon, biblically, is what happens when all of the nations of the earth gather together against Jerusalem and Judah, or the Jews. And so somehow or other, all the nations are going to be united in this assault against the city of Jerusalem. And that's the fascinating thing. That's the fascinating groundwork that I see being laid in the world today, especially with a lot of the anti-Jewish sentiment that's being fomented. Israel is being, you know, portrayed as this, you know, brutal, unjust dictator that's dispossessed these poor Palestinians from their land and, you know, thrown them out and so on. And Israel won't comply with the United Nations and all of these different things. And there's a subcurrent of anti-Jewish hostility that has shadows of what we thought during World War II. With Hitler and the Nazis and so on. So it's very, very interesting to see all of these elements come together, United Nations working, to see this world coalition against this common enemy, terrorism, that looks like it's going to be used to unite people somehow or other. And once they're united, will they then, or at least according to the Bible, they will at some point turn on the city of Jerusalem and the Jewish people themselves?
Well, I think it's so interesting. You know, I sense this all the time. I'm constantly getting letters, usually unsigned or anonymous letters with no return address and no signature on them, condemning the Jews. Or I'll get callers on my program. They already are violently anti-Semitic. They were behind the 9/11 attack. They were behind the assassination of John Kennedy. The Jews are responsible for all the problems of the world. And it's amazing to me how many people who profess to be Christians actually have this attitude. Now, I'm not saying there aren't some bad people who are Jewish, but they're bad people who say they're Protestants and bad people who claim to be Catholics. And I believe that all of these people, either they're wicked just independently or that many of them are frankly Luciferians, but to condemn a whole race of people, which is exactly what's happening. There is a tremendous increase or rise of anti-Semitism all across the world today. And people don't understand that. I believe that this is one of the things that will drive more and more Jews back to Israel. In other words, God will use the anti-Semitism to bring them back to the Holy Land, at least the people who are truly Jews.
Yeah, we quote in Megiddo from a book, and I think you're familiar with this, Dr. Stan, The Secret War Against the Jews.
Right. That's
John Loftus and Mark Arends.
Right.
This book has some great quotes in it, and we quote from the opening of the book that talks about how there's a worldwide, in the introduction it says, quote, the major powers of the world have repeatedly planned covert operations to bring about the partial or total destruction of Israel. And it goes on to talk about how the United States and Great Britain in many ways, you know, often pretend to be allies to the nation of Israel, but are in fact working behind the scenes to betray their secrets to the Arabs. And of course, when we look at the U.S. position with Israel, and then we look at, you know, the relation of the Bush family to the Saudi family, you know, and Arabs and the oil companies and so on, It's very fascinating. I don't pretend to understand it all, but it's very interesting how God said this is exactly what would happen ultimately. And the interesting thing, I would say this to people who find fault with Jews and, you know, who are in positions of power and so on, and certainly in every nation, among every race of people, there are those who are good and there are those who are not. But I agree with you. It's not fair to condemn an entire race of people. At any rate, God says in the Bible, in Ezekiel, he says that what he's doing with Israel, in terms of bringing them back into the land and then having all the nations surround them and so on, he says he's not doing it for their sake. In other words, he's not doing it because of them, because they're good people, because they're a godly people who have gone around and been faithful to God or anything like that. He says, God says that he's doing it for his holy name's sake. He says that, and the nation shall know that I am the Lord, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes. For I will gather you out of all nations and bring you again into your own land. The purpose of what's happening with Israel in this regard is so that the nations of the world will know that Jehovah Elohim, the God of the Bible, he is the one true God. He is the God who declares the end from the beginning, as he does from Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation. And so what's happening with Israel and this gathering of nations against them for Armageddon, this is to be a sign, a testimony to mankind that God is real, his son Jesus Christ is in fact the Messiah, and that salvation comes by faith in him alone. And so as much as men will, you know, either work for or against this conspiracy or that one, ultimately, I think what God is saying to mankind through all of these things is the testimony of the gospel is true. Man is a sinful creature, and he's in need of being reconciled to his Creator. Jesus said, apart from me, you can do nothing. God says, as I live, says the Lord, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his evil way and live. Ultimately, all these things that are happening are happening so that the hearts of men will be compelled to turn toward their Creator, to turn toward the one true God, to believe on Him, and to receive forgiveness for their sins and be saved. That's what all of this is really about.
And I think you're absolutely right. I remember one of my very, very wise men I studied under, what little I know about the scriptures I learned from him, and he said, you know, it really doesn't seem fair that God would pick the Jews. I mean, after all, sometimes they're very obstinate, so they turned against God on many occasions, and I don't know why God picked the Jews, but he did pick them, and he has a special place for them in his plan, and it's not up for you and me to question that. If we believe the scriptures, we have to believe that, and I believe we're seeing played out today. With all the machinations there in the Middle East, and with the fact that I believe that some of the leaders of the Jews are Luciferians and hate Judaism, I think that God somehow will turn this all out for His glory. Hey, we're out of time, Chris. Thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Chris Pinto. His video is Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. A fascinating two and a quarter hour video. You really can't stop watching. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I just want to mention, if you're interested in knowing more about getting Chris Pinto's excellent video, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. It's called Megiddo, the March to Armageddon.
And that's
Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. And I remember, well, we just got this. We didn't know Chris at all, never talked to him. And we sat down one evening to start to watch it. And we just couldn't stop. It was getting to be dinner time. I wanted to get some dinner, and my wife said, no way, we're going to watch this all the way through. And we did, to the very end. And well over 2 hours, fascinating history, very, very professionally done. We recommend Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, to every one of our listeners. And then, of course, we want to remind all of you that we are putting on a conference on the 6th of November here in the Monterey Bay area, just outside of Santa Cruz. It will, of course, just start at early in the morning and go until evening, and there can be lunch involved. We're going to have some excellent speakers bringing them in from different parts of the country. So we hope that many of you will want to come. Our telephone number, we hope you'll make your reservations. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You can make your reservations or contact us you can send us a check. But we, of course, hope many of you will be able to come. You'll bring your friends. And it's a good weekend, the 6th of November, far better than the one we had last year when we put our conference on. So, hope to see you then. Put that, check that off on your calendar. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our program 5 hours a day on the internet and not get a thing accomplished. You can hear us 4 hours a day on shortwave, and if you need a shortwave radio, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We actually have a newsletter. Our July newsletter is now finished. It'll be going out on Monday. If you'd like to get a free copy, it will give you tremendous insight into what really took place on September 11th, 2001. There is a smoking gun. It was in the 9/11 Commission staff report. So much of what the published report that you got is just simply divert people from really asking the serious questions. The process did not fail. It wasn't the process that was responsible. Somebody was responsible, and the thing is, the government knew ahead of time what was going to happen, and somebody decided not to intervene. I don't know whether the president knew. I don't know who knew, but I do know one thing, and that is the purpose of the 9/11 Commission was never to reach the truth. It was simply to give the American people that feeling that something was going to be done. It's sort of like the Warren Commission report and then the next investigation. It wasn't really until they had the House Select Committee investigate some years later that they found out that there were four shots. And then as soon as they found out there were four shots and there was a conspiracy behind the murder of President Kennedy, why, they immediately canceled the meetings, because I think the people on that committee were frankly afraid for their lives. We're in a spiritual battle for the souls of men. We're fighting evil, and evil many times at the highest levels of government. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. Remember our number. It's 1-800-544-8927. And please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Good evening once again. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Kevin Hall, and we're going to be talking about the presidents of mental health programs. He's got a wonderful program. It's called the New Freedom. That's just a wonderful program. And we're under the New Freedom. They're going to have a special testing for everybody for mental health. And I'm sure if you believe there's some sort of a Luciferian or satanic conspiracy out there, or you don't want to go along with globalism or the New World Order or the world fascist movement, or if you oppose the war, you probably are mentally ill. Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Monty.
Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're concerned about testing for mental health? Wouldn't it be good to find out people who do have problems and help them?
Well, an interesting thing about mental health diagnoses compared to regular medical diagnoses is there's no real medicine involved. There's no medical test. All the so-called mental illnesses are based on a diagnostic manual by the American Psychiatric Association called the DSM-4, and they're all based on opinion of behavior, unlike regular medical tests wherein you'll have blood tests or any of various x-rays or what have you. You'll see a real disease if you have tuberculosis, if you have diabetes, but with mental disorders, if you answer 10 out of 14 positive in different behaviors like attention deficit disorder or something like that, it will be determined based on that opinion that you have it. So it's really not real medicine. All they're really doing is looking at symptoms and never really addressing the underlying problem.
You know, it's, it really reminds me sort of when I was in the military, I met this young man, and of course I was a medical officer at the time, and he told me that his father was a doctor. His father had been practicing for 40 years, and I said, well, that was very interesting. And he said, and all those 40 years, my father never made a mistaken diagnosis. Now, that was something that just, you know, really piqued my curiosity, because nothing is absolute in medicine. That's one thing you learn in medical school. The one thing that you're absolutely sure of is there's absolute no absolutes. You can never say something is 100% correct or it's always correct. You just have to wait and see. Sometimes the diagnosis becomes apparent after a while. And so I said to this young man, your father's been practicing medicine for 40 years, and he's never made a mistake in medicine. He's never made a mistake in diagnosis. And the young man said, no, he's never made a mistake in diagnosis. And I said, well, what sort of a doctor is he? And he said, oh, he's a psychiatrist. So, you know, of course, who is to say the psychiatrist is right or wrong? Only the psychiatrist. And, of course, I believe he's made a lot of mistakes. I don't think we really understand the function of the mind at all. But what's really scary is when the government wants to begin testing the people in the name of the New Freedom Program. So go ahead, pick the story up from there, Kevin.
Well, basically, my organization is Citizens Commission on Human Rights, and I'm the New England director. And we've been investigating psychiatric human rights violations since the late 60s. And it started over the electroshock issue. To give an idea on diagnoses and how that works, a man was picked up in Pennsylvania for speaking gibberish, and that gibberish basically was Hungarian. Anyone who speaks English thinks Hungarian is gibberish. So he was picked up for his Hungarian tongue, thrown in Hungerford State Psychiatric Hospital, and he was given electroshock every other day. And he was speaking gibberish, so obviously it's not a false diagnosis here. So, anyway, the Church of Scientology found out about this and contacted psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Zaz, who is very outspoken, or a critic of the mental health field. And together we got this individual out of the psychiatric facility and helped establish laws throughout the country for informed consent on electroshock. And that was our beginning roots. And then we got more involved as time went on and the increased diagnosis of kids started skyrocketing out the roof. And so we've been very concerned about that, especially on how now about 8 million children are being put on these psychotropic drugs every day. And we're very concerned about the Bush Mental Health Initiative, because if what he wants to do for this initiative is ensure that every man, woman, and child in the country receives a mental health diagnosis, or at least once, and you know, continually throughout their life. And because the mental health diagnoses are so arbitrary, it sets up anyone to be labeled once you're labeled drugged. And right now, at 8 million kids being drugged daily, that's about 1 out of 9 kids in our country are put on these drugs. And what's also quite interesting is that 85% of the drugging of kids done planet-wide is done right here in the United States. So it's like saying that the only mentally ill kids in the world are in the U.S. But in reality, of course, it's not true, and it's because of the heavy marketing and lobbying of all these mental disorders and drugs that's going on.
Well, I think that the thing that people have to understand is that the Ritalin actually stunts the growth of the child, and their brain doesn't develop normally at all. And simply because the child is hyperactive, you do not necessarily want to put them on Ritalin at all. You know, I think this is one of the most incredible things that they've been able to sell this. And this is frankly harmful to children. And we've certainly done interviews with Dr. Peter Bragan in the past, who was on the staff at Johns Hopkins. And there is no question at all that the children actually who do get the Ritalin do have smaller brains and smaller stature, and it interferes with their endocrine function. In fact, I was just doing an interview with somebody within the last 24 hours pointing out that Lisa Minnelli had written a book about her mother, Judy Garland, and when Judy was going to be in The Wizard of Oz, why the studios started her on Ritalin because she was just adolescent, she was just going, you know, into her menarche, and they wanted to stop that, and they knew even even at that time, which was, 40 years ago or 50 years ago, when they made The Wizard of Oz, that the Ritalin would actually, or some similar drug, would actually stunt her growth and of course, stop her maturation, at least until they could get through with that film. And after being on it, why she stayed on Ritalin. Now, whether the story is true, I don't know. But anyway, this is the story that was told. But I think that we are experimenting with things, we are doing terrible things to our children, and yet I don't think the average parent understands that the people who say, oh, we've got to get your child on Ritalin so they're not so disruptive and so they'll be able to get better grades, the teachers are not in a position to make those decisions, and I fear that most doctors are not in a position to make the decision because they do not know the harmful and addicting tendencies of Ritalin use.
Well, last year, the Journal of the American Medical Association got as bright as children in knowing what the drug really does. They basically did a study or published a study on methylphenidate, which is Ritalin or Concerta, this type drug, and compared it to cocaine and showed that basically it reacts the same way on the body as does cocaine. It's pretty much the same drug, only that the Ritalin is stronger than cocaine. And the way they determine that is a chemical that goes from a neurotransmitter, which is just a natural substance in the body that goes from nerve to nerve. And they determine it by seeing how much of the neurotransmitter dopamine it blocked. And the methylphenidate or Ritalin actually blocked more dopamine than did the cocaine, showing how it's got a stronger effect on the brain, and that's why kids have been snorting this drug for years. They crush and snort it, and a lot of people out there might wonder why would a kid who's running around wild and crazy like all of a sudden be calmed down by an amphetamine? You'd think he'd be running around twice as fast, but drugs basically work in a similar fashion. Say for example, alcohol. If you take a little bit of alcohol, maybe a beer or two, you tend to get more up, more giddy. If you take more than that, you're tranquilized. If you take too much, it's toxic and will kill you. The same thing with a drug like Ritalin or Adderall or Dexedrine, these amphetamine-type drugs. If you take a little bit, a few milligrams, the kids will be running around. If you take more, they'll be tranquilized. And I've gone out on the streets, interviewing street users or street snorters of Ritalin to find out how much they use. And we found out that the newer high school or college age user of the drug usually started on anywhere between 5 to 10 milligrams of Ritalin to get high for about 3 hours. And you know, this person may weigh roughly about 150 pounds at 5 to 10 milligrams. Now the little Johnny, who's just distracted because he doesn't understand how to read properly, he may weigh 50 pounds, and they start him anywhere from around 20 milligrams and may go up to 60. So if you compare 20 to 5 at one-third of the body weight, you're talking 12 times the dosage that kids are prescribed than the adult snorters take, and that's why they're tranquilized. They're basically mega-dosing all these kids with these drugs, and that's the big lie they're not telling you.
Well, of course, the problem with the use of Ritalin is the physiological effect far and beyond the psychological effect or the impact on the mind. And there really are studies that show that these children all have smaller brains, they have smaller development, but they don't tell you that. Our children are under attack today in the schools. Now, we know, for instance, if a child takes a Luvox or a similar drug, they can't get in the military. What about the children who take Ritalin? Do you know if they'll let them in the military?
No, they won't.
All right, fine. So here we're cutting back on the number of soldiers we can have, people in the military, because about a sixth of them are on Ritalin?
Probably one in nine.
Okay, well, now, Chris, what is this new mental health program that the president is pushing?
Well, it started in Texas when he was President Bush was governor in 1995. It was the Texas Medication Algorithm program here, project. And what it was doing was a couple things. First of all, what they would do is whenever anyone was labeled with a mental illness or a mental disorder, the idea was to start them on the newer, more expensive psychiatric drugs like, here's Zyprexas and your Risperdal and all these very expensive drugs.
Now, whose idea was this? And is this part of the president's mental health program, or is this a different program?
Well, this is what started under the president in 1995. This whole thing's been an evolution that's now gone nationwide. It started in Texas, and it was with the funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The University of Texas was involved, and they had various psychiatrists, psychologists on their commission to decide how to treat mental health in the state of Texas.
All right, fine. Is this a voluntary program? Is this a compulsory program? Is this a recommended program?
This program basically was initiated as an administrative action by the Health and Human Services in Texas. So it was a mandate down on how all the Medicaid money would be spent, et cetera. So
I know, but I mean, for instance, was there something that every school child would be evaluated, every government employee would be evaluated? I mean, how did they determine who was going to be brought under treatment, or was it simply if people needed the drugs, they'd pay for them?
Well, the Texas program didn't go into the diagnosing as much as the New Bush Initiative. What that basically dealt with was making sure the more expensive, newer drugs in the market were the first things that people would use in a doctor's office and mental institutions. It's what Medicaid would pay for. And, of course, that's a big money maker for all the drug companies to make sure that the newer, more expensive drugs are used and not the generics and so on. Now, what happened from there is the president put together a new Freedom Commission on Mental Health a few years back.
A new Freedom Commission on Mental Health. I love that term, new freedom, because really what you're getting into is going to be compulsory.
Oh, it's obviously a public relations term. But 11 of the 22 members of that panel are associated with the Texas program. And it was basically a big pharmaceutical push that was put together, that the president put together here.
Now, you think it was put together primarily as a means of transferring money to the drug companies, which are so generous in the contributions to his candidacy?
Well, the British Medical Journal reported a lot how the Bush campaign and the Republican Party were actually getting far more money from the pharmaceutical companies than the Democrats. Although, I'm not trying to say to vote the other way, because if Al Gore was in office, his wife was on psychotropic drugs and she wanted to be a child psychiatrist, so she probably would have implemented this program even faster than Bush. The bottom line is he put together a committee of so-called experts, and they came back with this proposal that he's implementing. And the way now they're looking at diagnosing every man, woman, and child is, first of all, looking through the public schools, they figure they have a captive audience of 58 million Americans right there, 52 million school children, and another 6 million employees. And what they'll be doing there for their initiative is having all the kids go home with requests for mental health exams. So in other words, the parent signs it off. It's a standard thing that about every parent's going to sign. And what happens in the public schools is if you refuse to sign something, they tend to pull you into a team meeting with a group of, your teachers, your vice principal, school psychologist, guidance counselors, and they'll start telling you how your child needs this testing or this type of medication or what have you, and they lower their glasses and furl up their brow and then give you this look and make the head go back and forth, and basically tell you that you're a bad parent if you don't get your child the treatment they need. And if you refuse, oftentimes what they'll do is call it medical neglect and file a petition with Child Protective Services, basically calling you a bad parent where you may possibly lose your child. So there's a lot of pressure. So basically, they figure in this way they can get all the school kids diagnosed. Now, what they're looking at doing with preschoolers and elderly and this type of population is to make mental health exams part of your regular physical exams and to urge all insurance companies to cover this. And so that means whenever a child goes into his pediatrician, prior to the first visit will be some type of mental health exam. And that means, of course, we'll have a great increase in kids being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or obsessive compulsive or whatever disorder you want to put there. And they also plan at diagnosing the pregnant mothers as they're going through the pregnancy. So they'll start with the mother right there and continue on. And obviously it's also a problem with the elderly being put on drugs, as there's some studies out there showing that most elderly who are in nursing home facilities are on psychotropic drugs, and many are mentally impaired because of that.
Well, I think that the use of drugs, unless they're absolutely necessary, is really very deleterious to the individual. Certainly, psychotropic drugs can almost have a reverse effect on the elderly. Sometimes you give them sedatives, they go wild. But the idea of putting our children onto psychotropic drugs, because they're hyperactive or because they have difficulty concentrating in class, maybe if we had better education, maybe if we had better books, maybe if we stimulated these children and challenged them, they wouldn't be so hyperactive. And we're having real problems today because of government policies. And I really, of course, caution anybody who has a child in a government school to get them out of a government school. There's any possible way you can do it. And if not, certainly do not, under any circumstances, agree to have your child put on Ritalin. They'll never get in the military. And it, of course, can stunt their growth and impact on their mind forever. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Kevin Hall. We're talking about the President's new Freedom Mental Health Program. What's the official title for it, Kevin?
It's his mental health, the President's Mental Health Initiative.
President's Mental Health Initiative.
Correct. And as was mentioned earlier, it's basically come about because it's a huge marketing push and a huge political push by lobbyists from the pharmaceutical and mental health industries to basically reach out and get more people turned into permanent mental patients, of course, where you can keep the billing going over and over. No one cures from these mental disorders with these drugs. They'll tell you that it's a maintenance program, so it's quite a boondoggle in that they, you know, they can label you, you're labeled for life, and they can bill for life, and that's why mental health expenditures keep going up year after year.
And so what, now, how aggressive are they going to be? We just heard about this new program, this so-called New Freedom Mental Health Program. Is this really taking off? Has this been legislated? Is this created by executive fiat or by executive order? How did it come about?
Well, it's created by executive order. It's a mandate that goes out to all the federal U.S. agencies. And, of course, funding is also needed to increase all these mental health exams. And right now, $20 million has been approved by the House Appropriations Committee for mental health examinations as part of this mental health initiative. So it's unfortunately moving along very fast.
But $20 million isn't going to go very far. That's just a drop in the bucket, you know, as far as mental health examinations are concerned. So are they going to get sources from other sources? Are they going to keep raising the amount of money or what?
Well, it's actually not a drop in the bucket for examinations, because all they do is take these yes, no, maybe type tests, and they look at the check marks and determine whether or not someone's mentally ill from that.
All right, fine. So these are not going to be individual examinations at all.
No, these are going to be group. And, like, you'll hit all the kids in the school. It's very, and it'd be computerized, et cetera.
Well, can parents just say, we don't want our children taking these tests? We don't want them taking any tests that are not specifically related to their schoolwork?
Well, you can definitely do that, but the reality is the majority of parents will say, oh, the school's just trying to see how my child is doing, and that's a wonderful thing. They'll go right along. Obviously, anyone out listening, I would advise that you not let your child go through one of these mental health exams. Now, what happens is once the examinations occur, though, then psychiatrists and pediatricians, etc., can label someone with a mental disorder and then start billing their, you know, billing their insurance and billing Medicaid. There's really no cap on Medicaid, so they can pretty much label and bill at will. If they have a mental disorder, they're constantly trying to increase the mental health coverage with things called, like, parity mental health, for example, which parity meaning equal. So what they're trying to do is say that you should be able to bill mental health the same way you do with other medical disorders. Now, there really isn't parity between medicine and mental health, because only in mental health can you determine that someone's mentally ill. You can force drug them against their will, and you can bill for that. You can't do that in any other area of medicine. And plus,
hold that thought for just a moment, Kevin. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Kevin Hall. We're talking about the President's New Freedom Mental Health Initiative, which is really rather frightening. First of all, the federal government has no business being involved in federal health. If the President or anybody in his administration believed in the Constitution, they would realize that what they're doing is unconstitutional. Matters dealing with mental health or disease or anything else is something that should be taken care of at the state and at the local level, not by the federal government. Kevin, where does the federal government get off even being involved in this?
Well, it's quite interesting on the constitutional angle of mental health you brought up. The way mental health initiated in this country is unconstitutional. People are picked up off the street and force-drugged. This is a violation of the Fourth Amendment of illegal search and seizure. And then, once they're held, they may get a hearing on whether or not they're mentally ill and or a danger to themselves or others or whatever the state standard is. And what happens in these cases is you have the individual who is often drugged severely so they look psychotic, placed in front of a judge, and he has to go up. He's the person labeled as a mental disorder who's going up against the treating psychiatrist who is a so-called professional. So you're uneven there, and there is no right whatsoever to a jury trial. So you can't, you know, this is obviously a constitutional violation too. And this also happens, of course, in the social services cases, child protection, wherein children are removed or forced drugged, etc. And under the guise of privacy for the individual, as they don't get the constitutional rights to a jury.
Well, I'm really very, very concerned that the federal government is even considering this. It's totally unconstitutional, and simply on that basis, despite the fact that they're going to create so much trouble. But this, what they're doing is it constantly expanding their control over everybody's life in the United States. And this is exactly what they did in communist Russia, what they did in communist China, and they're doing it here. Why are they worried about it? They would think they would have enough things to worry about without getting into mental health. That's something that ought to be taken care of, certainly at the local level.
Well, one thing interesting you bring up with Nazi Germany, the Jews, for example, they were basically all diagnosed as inferior with a mental disorder. The person who started the whole idea of racial hygiene was a psychiatrist, Ernst Rudin, and he later became Hitler's right-hand man for his ideology of massacring everyone. He pushed through the sterilization laws of 36.
He was a very good friend of Margaret Sanger's. In fact, Ernst Rudin from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute was frequently writing for Margaret Sanger of Planned Parenthood.
And anyone who was to be exterminated basically was up to a psychiatrist in a center in Berlin called T4 Center, who would check off whether or not someone's to be exterminated based on their fitness to be alive. And this was basically a mental health diagnosis. So that's one of the major problems, of course, with mental health diagnoses not being medical. And you can label anyone whatever you want. It's very similar to the witch hunt that occurred in Salem years ago. Someone is a witch, they're gone. Same thing with the mental disorder. Someone's not acting properly, they're institutionalized, and then they're basically gone too, because they'll be drugged to the point where they cannot properly function in the near future.
Well, I think it's a frightening thing to contemplate, but I think that the biggest thing is that why we ought to just simply say this is none of the federal government's business. Now, is there any opposition in Congress, in the House of Representatives, or in the Senate to this expansion of government control? I mean, here we are, we're running one of the biggest deficits in all history. The government says the deficit's going to be $445 billion. It really looks, with the amount of money they got in this last month, that it's going to be closer to $500 billion, plus they're going to have to steal another $250 billion from Social Security and Medicare. And then we know that right after the election, they're going to ask for another $50 billion to fund the war in Iraq through the end of the year. So, end of the prescribed time. So, you know, why in heaven's name do they want to take on something additional?
Well, it's about the lobbying. With the pharmaceutical money, it's a huge lobby, and there's over 600 pharmaceutical lobbyists on Capitol Hill. That is more than the total amount of senators and congressmen we have there. So basically what you have is a lobbyist or two camping out in every single office.
Well, I heard that, and I got this from Congressman Ron Paul, that when they were trying to get through this latest bit of legislation that had to do with the Medicare prescription bill, they had 300 lobbyists, each receiving $50,000 a month, lobbying on the Capitol Hill to get through that drug prescription legislation. Gee, they must have been awfully interested in helping the old folks, don't you think? Of course, they were all paid for by the drug companies. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, 1-800 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And before we went to the break, I was simply commenting that I was at a meeting recently, about 10 days ago, up in Reno, and there was a representative there who works very closely with Representative Ron Paul. And he repeated this several times because it was so unbelievable. There were 300 lobbyists, each receiving $50,000 a month. $50,000 a month to lobby the congressman to get that Medicare prescription drug bill through the House of Representatives. It was a terrible bill. It's simply a matter of transferring money from the taxpayers to the drug companies, and it had the full support of the Bush administration and certainly the full support of the drug companies. And if they're so interested in the elderly, why were they spending $50,000 a month for 300 lobbyists to go to? I mean, that's there's one lobbyist for about every two legislators, to try to convince them of the importance of getting that legislation through. I just got a book today. People send me free books because they want me to get the authors on the program. The title was The $800 Million Pill, and it's all a defense of the drug industry and their obscene prices so that they can create new medicines to help humanity. The only trouble, they're not working on new medicines to help humanity. They're not working on new antibiotics. In fact, the antibiotics we have are, the drugs are developing resistance to them. What they're doing is coming up with new drugs for cholesterol, so they can get everybody on those drugs, and new drugs for hypertension, and new mental health drugs. But what we really need, they're not coming up with, and this is what I'm so concerned about. I really hate to say this, but I believe that many of the major drug companies are far more concerned about obscene profits than they are in helping mankind. So pick up the story from there, Kevin.
Well, an interesting thing in the lobbying, it's not just that they have lobbyists in every office on Capitol Hill and state levels, but they also have funded so-called parents groups or human rights types groups to do their dirty work for them. So when people would normally be there to speak up against all this abuse or high prices or harm done by these products of psychiatry and pharmaceuticals, groups like the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and which pushes all these mental disorders and involuntary commitment, and groups like Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Disorder, which promote attention deficit disorder and Ritalin and all this.
Hold that bell for just a moment.
Okay, well, these...
Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Kevin Hall, and before we went to the break, I had simply mentioned that I had been with one gentleman who works very closely with Congressman Ron Paul about 2 weeks ago, and he was saying that when they were trying to get the prescription drug bill through Congress, they had 300 lobbyists, each paid $50,000 a month, and he repeated it, $50,000 a month to lobby the members of Congress. They had about one lobbyist for every two members of Congress, and they twisted their arms. They did everything possible to get that legislation through, and believe me, they weren't interested in trying to help the elderly. This is a pass-through vehicle from the taxpayers to the drug companies, and I really think it's obscene. Our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Kevin Hall. We're talking about the President's New Freedom Bill, New Freedom Mental Health Bill. Isn't that wonderful? But, of course, it's really a gamut to get people onto drugs and for you to be labeled as seriously mentally ill. What they're going to do is start testing our children, and then the government employees, employees of the school districts, and then government employees, and then, well, who knows who may be next. Maybe it's somebody who listens to shortwave radio or the Internet, or who believes that there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. But let's go to Roger calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How you doing?
Yeah, hi, gents. Thanks. And unless you think that $50,000 a month is excessive, that is actually an excellent return on investment for Drug Co.
Okay.
It's somewhat related. I think what happens is the kids that are, say, just below average all the way up the range to the very brightest, I'm guessing there would already have been statistics to bear that out, that they tend to be the most likely to get the Ritalin because they're stuck in these classrooms, and of course they're trouble because they're not being challenged even just below the mean.
Well, that's a very interesting point there. It's actually a mix. Often, lots of times, the brightest kids are bored to death, so they're not paying attention, and they end up being labeled and drugged. And what happens a lot, though, the poorer kids are also labeled a lot, mainly because they're on Medicaid and it's easy money. What happens with education is most kids who are acting up in class, the vast majority, are just doing so because they aren't properly taught. Education's totally changed. There used to be a very common sense form of education wherein you would learn the basics. You would learn phonics, how to say your words, you learn grammar, you know, the way in which one communicates, and if there was something that you didn't understand on the page, you were taught to bring out a simple dictionary that it was easily understood and look up what math means, what algebra means, and all that. Now what happens is they don't teach phonics much at all, there's very little grammar taught, and you can't find a dictionary in a classroom without a search party. So if the child's reading along and say you and I were reading along and it says in here that the children ran home during the sight of crepuscule. You know, you think, what's going on here? You think there's some monster out there, but if you look it up in the dictionary, crepuscule is just twilight. Oh, it makes sense. Now, the children don't have access to look up what crepuscule is or what an iguana is or what have you, so they can't pay attention, and they're looking out the window and they start acting up. They know they can't read. These are your attention deficit disorders, your oppositional defiance, compulsive disorders, your opposition defiance disorders, et cetera, down the line, where you're learning, on the other, you're learning disabilities. And basically, what's happening is that it was an intentional plan out there to ruin education, to have children manifest these so-called mental disorders so they could sell and market their drug. And it started back in the 20s with a psychologist named James Cattell, who started the look-say methods instead of phonics.
Well, there's no question that there's been a conscious effort to dumb down our children, and they've done a pretty good job of it. So many of our children really can't read or can't read well. Well, did you have anything else you wanted to say there, Roger?
Yeah, and by the way, you just have to love that diagnosis, ODD or odd.
All right, go ahead.
Hey, it's similar to what Michael Rose, himself a Roman Catholic, wrote a book not too long ago on the crisis with the Catholic Church and the pedophilia, where the priests in the theological cemeteries, the candidates, that is, are, you know, if they express any revulsion at that, then they're packed off to the more transcendent priesthood, the psychiatrist, to be exorcised from their homophobia.
Well, exactly. There were you're right. Psychologists are right at the door testing new prospective priests, and basically, you know, that's what really brought down the Catholic Church. They were basically promoting the homophobia through psychological testing, and then once there were some of these or a lot of these cases of sexual abuse, and the mental health took over again, wherein the Catholic Church paid over $100 million for psychiatric treatment for the problems of homophobia, sexual abuse of kids that they created right from the start.
Okay, that book, of course, by Michael Rose was Goodbye, Good Men, and a very tragic story of what's happened to the Catholic seminaries. But I would simply point out that both branches of Christendom are under attack today. They infiltrated the Catholic Church, they've infiltrated the Protestant Church, and where do the people who love the Lord go? Well, they're having real problems today. And, of course, what we're talking about this evening is simply another manifestation of the attack on the family, the attack on the individual, the attack on the mind.
Yes,
the telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead, Roger. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, my point was just a little broader than the Catholic problem was, and I think probably Paul Vitz and his excellent Psychology as Religion touches on this, that we have a psychology being made into the ersatz replacement priesthood, one notch at least above everything else. And of course, is it going to take 20 years till it's basically exposed as the pseudoscience it is, along with sociology or applied Marxism?
Well, I don't know, but our job is, of course, to get people to realize that psychiatry is a very inexact science, and most of the people in it have real emotional problems. Okay, thanks so much, Roger. Kevin, did you have goodbye? Kevin, did you have a remark at all?
No, he made some very good points there, and psychiatry really isn't, as I pointed out earlier, like real medicine. It's really junk science in that when they label someone with a mental disorder and start drugging, they're just looking at symptoms. It's similar to prescribing aspirins for a headache when underneath lies the tumor.
Okay, fine. Well, if our listeners out there would like to know a little bit more about the prescription of Ritalin, we have a wonderful four-tape set with four experts in this field. It's called Ritalin, and it goes, of course, primarily into the use of Ritalin, its disastrous effects, but it touches on some of the other psychotropic drugs that have been given to our children. So if I could recommend, if you need to get more information on this, the documentation for what we're talking about, the four-tape set entitled Ritalin, available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we do hope that many of you will want to avail yourself of the materials we have. If you'd like to get one of our catalogs, of course, we'd be glad to send it to you, because we cover so many of these important issues from the aspartame to the zebras. No, I don't know about zebras, but certainly an awful lot of other important information. Well, Y2K, I guess. We had a tape set on that, although there's not too much demand for that anymore. Although it was a real problem, but it's amazing how efficient the private industry is, corporate function is, because they weren't going to have a chance on being set down. They spent literally billions of dollars to solve the Y2K problem, and fortunately they did. Well, Kevin, what can be done to abort or to head off this new Freedom Mental Health Program that the administration has introduced?
Well, I'm sure that your audience is one that's more active than passive. So it's very important to call your U.S. congressmen and senators and the president and basically let them know that you're not going to tolerate this Orwellian takeover of the mind by having everyone take these mental health exams, and that they cannot afford or push any more funding toward this any longer, and actually must really cut back on all the psychiatric drugging of kids. That's a real mental health problem we have. You just got to be active and really get out there. And a lot of people out there also being active, as this audience is, excuse me, know people who are in positions of power or know others who are in positions of power. So definitely use them to get the message across, too.
And I really think it's so very important that there's, if people get involved, the legislators will listen. And if they know that there is a constituency for an issue, why, they will respond to it, you know. And a few dozen calls sometimes can make the very definite impact upon how a legislature votes. So did you have any specific legislation or specific bills in mind?
Well, basically, I'm looking at the President's Mental Health Initiative and the aspect of diagnosing every man, woman, and child for these, with these psychological tests.
But does it have is there any specific bill that's opposing it or in favor of it?
No, it's not a bill. It's basically a mandate that came down from the president to his agencies, and then Congress can stop it by not funding it. So that's the type of thing that has to happen. And one important aspect you brought up before that I thought was very interesting on what these drugs do is you brought up how these psychostimulants like Ritalin, et cetera, cause brain shrinkage. It's very true. They actually shrink the brain on an average of 10% in size per various studies. But on top of that, I would not want to overlook the psychological effects of what these drugs do. For example, most of the school shootings that occur out in society that really upset a lot of people, such as Columbine, these kids are on psychiatric drugs currently or just withdrawing where the effects are stronger. For example, Eric Harris of Columbine, he was on Luvox. Kipling Kinkle in Oregon, who shot 14 kids, two of them dying, was on Prozac and Ritalin. And a lot of these murder-suicides you see all over the place, it's easy to trace them back to one of these psychiatric drugs. And what psychiatry and the pharmaceutical companies will try to tell you, or tell you through their front groups that they fund, like the National Alliance on the Mentally Ill, is that they'll try to tell you that the only reason they became violent is because they were no longer on their medication. What they don't tell you is that it's the withdrawal effects that are actually more serious in causing the problem. It is an actual drug effect. It's not because they're off of these drugs.
In fact, I think that the boy who was on the Luvox at Columbine actually wanted to go in the military. And when he applied for the military, they found he'd been on Luvox. They said, no way. And that just really infuriated him. And I'm sure if he'd been looking forward to going in the military, something he wanted to do, why he certainly wouldn't have decided to take his own life and the lives of so many other children. And it was this barrier to his going in the military. And I don't think that the average parent realizes when you let them start playing with your child's mind, why that record will be them the rest of their life. And there may be lots of jobs they're not going to be able to do or get simply because they've been on psychotropic medication.
Well, it's a lot stronger than this. It's not that someone got overly upset because they couldn't go in the army that causes someone to go in a shooting rampage. I've dealt with several people who had violent reactions on these drugs, and to give you an example of how psychotic they can make you, there was one lady, for example, in Dover, New Hampshire. She's taking what was Prozac at the time a few years back, and she's taking it. She's feeling all kinds of happy. She decides, oh, I'm going to kill myself, and it's a wonderful day. So she goes down to the local gun shop, picks up a shotgun, buys it, and is whistling on her way home. And then she gets home, and she puts the gun up to her mouth, is about to pull the trigger, and then she notices her kids are watching TV in the other room and doesn't want to disturb their TV show. That's how out there she is. And she, it was all because of the drug. So instead, she swallowed a bottle of pills and literally became brain dead. There was no sign of life, and she came back to life. And the pharmaceutical companies were fighting the coverage of this so hard. That was the extreme of the case that I needed to get any media coverage at all, by saying a lady comes back from the dead to tell a story of harm from this drug. And often what precipitates someone becoming violent on this drug is something called akathisia. It's a Greek term that means can't sit still. It's often what will happen is the person on one of these newer antidepressants or major tranquilizers like Haldol too sometimes, they'll start getting up at 3 in the morning, painting the house, mowing the lawn, all kinds of things, and they'll be in a psychotic state. This often precipitates their acts of psychotic violence. And after this situation, usually they don't remember a lot of the things that they had done, but only know by accounts of other people.
And I think that's really very, very true, and certainly there's a great deal of concern that sometimes these medications, which we assume are going to actually sedate, are actually stimulant, and there's a great deal of talk today about now the drug companies, or at least the FDA, is going to begin to analyze the relationship between the use of psychotropic drugs in children and the suicide rates, and there's a great deal of evidence that psychotropic drugs actually increase the suicide rate among children. Have you run into that, Kevin?
Oh, lots of times. And the FDA is basically doing a cover-up. They're trying to send it down to the researchers at Columbia University to cover up the suicidal effects of these drugs. It started because Britain did some studies on it and found that children especially were becoming more likely to commit suicide or have suicidal thoughts on these newer antidepressants, so they banned 5 of them. That forced the FDA to take action and have an investigation, wherein they tried to whitewash it, but the pediatric subcommittee of the APA was so outraged at the strength of the testimony that they decided something had to be done about it. But in the meantime, one of the chief researchers for the FDA wanted to testify about his findings, and he was banned by the FDA from testifying. What he found out was, from his research, was that with double-blind studies, those children who took the antidepressants were twice as likely as those who didn't to want to commit suicide.
Well, I think those are amazing, amazing figures, and we really have a terrible problem as far as the use of these psychotropic drugs in our children. And what would your advice, Kevin, be to the average parent? You know, if they go to, you know, the teacher sends a message home that the child should be on Ritalin, or they want to send them to a doctor to get Ritalin prescribed, or they want the parent to come down and discuss the possibility of putting their child under medications, how should the parent respond?
Nicely and calmly reject the offer, because these psychiatric drugs don't cure anything. What you're doing is turning a normal child into a permanent mental patient, which funds the pharmaceutical mental health market for the rest of their life, and your child has become a victim from this. If you really reject strongly, then there's a good chance that they'll file a medical neglect report on you with Child Protection Service to take your child away. Now, one thing that they can't do per federal law, which teachers and school administrators do all the time, is they cannot require or suggest that a child take a psychiatric drug. It's a violation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, because these are not doctors.
No, but of course they've been doing it all along.
Absolutely. And you let them know that they're violating the law. And one thing you can do is contact Citizens Commission on Human Rights at cchr.org, and we will help you with that situation.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, basically, all these mental disorders that are out there, our opinion, if there's something really wrong, then there might be an underlying medical problem, like a heart or lung situation. Food allergies can cause a problem. If someone's not properly metabolizing copper or zinc, you can look like a screaming schizophrenic. By saying someone has a mental disorder and that it's a disease, that is not real medicine. Don't listen to it. Find the real problem. And usually with children, they just need tutoring and to know what words like algebra mean.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Kevin, Kevin Hall. And thank you so much. Appreciate you being with us tonight.
Thank you for your show, Dr.
Right, bye-bye. Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and I think this is an important subject. If you want to know more about it, we do have an excellent four-tape set for great interviews we did on the subject of Ritalin, and of course it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we really are under attack today. We're at war. There are those who would harm our children, who would harm and really destroy our nation. Now, this is not the average individual, but there really are some wicked and evil people out there. And behind all the efforts to make profits on the part of the drug companies is another agenda. And until you understand that there really is what we call the Brotherhood of Darkness out there, until you have a chance to listen to a four-tape set we have called The New Order of the Barbarians, you're not going to really understand what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a group that calls itself the Order, and one of the members actually blew the whistle. And it's all laid out in a wonderful four-tape set called The New Order of the Barbarians. Four interviews and talks with Dr. Dinigan, who I heard the whole story laid out from him back in 1969. Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I just casually mentioned that I guess this evening Kevin Hall is very articulate, and I certainly enjoyed talking with him, but I certainly do not approve of the Scientology movement, and they sort of stuck him onto my program because I believe in the subject. I think it's very important. But Scientology is, in my estimation, a very dangerous organization, and I would certainly suggest any of our listeners avoid Scientology. You get into this, and well, it can transform your life, and I can tell you, not for the better. And this is not in any way a Christian or pro-Christian organization, and I'll have to get after the scheduler who talked me into putting somebody from Scientology on. And of course they really want you to contact them, and then they'll get your name, and then the next thing you know, you'll have somebody visiting you. And so I just would caution you, I'd be very, very wary of Scientology. Now, I've had their people on my programs in the past, and sometimes they will take very, very popular issues. I remember we had some people from Scientology who were very concerned about the ozone issue. But they use the issues, of course, to get your support. It's sort of like the Moonies or the LaRoucheites, the followers of Lyndon LaRouche, and much of what they say is absolutely correct. But of course, it's the rest of the story that gets you into trouble. So certainly I advise you to be very, very cautious. We always try to screen the programs we do. I thought the material put forward was very, very good this evening as far as the real threat from the president's New Freedom Mental Health Initiative. That's the New Freedom Mental Health Initiative. Really, the New Freedom was a book written by Woodrow Wilson back in 1913. It was a slogan of the Woodrow Wilson administration. Great slogan, but of course they're not talking about freedom. They're talking about getting your kids addicted, and of course we know that in college, the drug of choice for students, college students, is Ritalin, because it gives them a high, and they can stay up all night studying with it, and then they can take it in between times for recreational purposes. These children know how to go to the doctor and how to answer the questions, to give the impression of attention deficit disorder. They even have little booklets to tell them exactly how to hoodwink the doctor into giving them the medicines. And let me tell you, this is a terrible medicine. You do not want to get your child onto Ritalin, because it will stunt their growth and shrink their brains, and of course interfere with their physiological development. And the tragedy is, this is not being brought out. The average doctor does not know the disastrous effects of many of the drugs he's being put out. And the reason he doesn't know is, who do you think finances the medical journals he reads? Why, the drug companies. Who do you think finances many of the lectures that he hears? And I know this to be a case because I go to the hospital on a regular basis, and this drug company is bringing this doctor in from the East Coast to talk to 35 or 40 doctors at the hospital. They're paying big bucks to come and push their line. Who do you think it is that funds many of the meetings that the doctors go to? why the big drug companies, and believe me, who does it think that rewards the people in the Federal Drug Administration who compromise their principles and pass drugs that never should be passed for public use? Why? Well, the drug companies don't necessarily pay them, although they do have special stipends for many people working at the National Institute of Health. But what they do is when you retire from the drug company, then you go to work for the drug company, and you get a golden parachute, and you're made for life. And unfortunately, this is the reality of the world we live in, because this is what happens when a nation turns its back on God. And there is no right and wrong. When you take God out of the equation, men do whatever they want to and look after their own interests rather than what is right. So we ask you to pray for America. Remember our number. It's 1-800-544-8927. Remember, we're going to have a meeting here in Santa Cruz on the 6th of November all day with lunch, and hope you'll be able to come. And, of course, remember our website, RadioLiberty.com. And your job is to tell other people about our program. And then we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection and revival. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.